by nature, are sharks aggressive?
No, they're not. They're not.
So this is mushrooms growing out of a wasp.
I mean, we're exposed to literally thousands of synthetic chemicals just in our everyday life.
My family is normal. I just think, oh, every family is just three people.
So if we put hair inside bricks, it will be like insulating your home.
Hi, welcome to Think Sustainability, a show where we look at practical solutions for a better planet. Today on the show...
It's better to have, like, these sort of bags because they're more sustainable, they're more, like, and you can, like, wash them again.
And, like, it takes ages for plastic bags to break down. Yeah.
Making your own reusable shopping bags. You'll hear about an initiative bringing sustainable minds together of all ages. And installing solar panels onto apartment complexes. Why it's more complicated than you might think. But first on the show, a bar hire venture is bringing a sustainable ethos to drinking. Called Trolleyed, they use only locally foraged and organic produce to make cocktails with a conscience. Producer Shane Anderson sat down with the founders of Trolleyed at their Inner West headquarters to talk about their business over a sustainable gin and tonic.
My name's Byron John Wolfring.
And I'm Christopher Glenn Thomas.
Who are you both?
We are Trolleyed.
Yes.
Anyone can be Trolleyed?
Yeah, just come and hang out responsibly and sustainably.
And how long have you been doing this for?
I've been getting Trolleyed for 4 years now. Started selling lemonade at the markets down in Bondi from the old upcycled Ansett airline trolleys. And have developed our business model ever since.
We mix the cocktails on and from the airline trolleys using organic, native and foraged ingredients.
And where do you get the ingredients from?
From the trees around Sydney. From the streets to your treats is the phrase. All of the garnishes on the way to the gigs, usually. You know, different spots, so you go and grab different edible flowers and weeds, and you know, both invasive and indigenous. And then for the season, so we hit the Illawarra plum season, the ribery season, the midgenberry. So we grab them literally from the streets around Sydney.
Where did you learn this botany from? Is it something you've always been interested in?
It's been an evolution. When we first started up, we started doing the organic markets, like pretty much that lemonade stand kind of dream. And then we like found out about Lemon Myrtle, and we had great mentors along the way, which really helped out.
Diego Bonetto, the weedy one.
Yeah, Diego Bonetto's go around, like, opening your eyes to a realization of how much stuff around you is actually edible
and useful.
You picked up this leaf before. What is it? What is it I'm drinking at
so
the moment?
A Lemon Myrtle leaf sticking in your gin and tonic there.
Nice.
Yeah, Aussie gin. There's Archie Rose in there, isn't it? Mm-hmm. A bit of tastiness. That good local distillers around the corner. We'd like to support local as much as possible. Like, going along and building up to what we've done, we've found a lot of the big transnational booze companies try to get in there and bully you around and try to get their product all over your thing. But it's like they kind of push out the small independent distilleries and everything, the great little businesses that are opening up.
And what kind of events do you guys normally work at?
Some's for show and some's for dough. You know, we do all sorts of events depending on what day of the week it is or whatever. We've been cracking into festivals this year, so that's been lots of fun all up and down the coast. And then we like to support lots of gigs that are true to our ethos as well. We sponsor the fun stuff and they're the good ones. And then, yeah, there's the corporate ones that they pay you to do.
Robin Hood the shit out of it.
Yeah.
I mean, you said you follow kind of seasonal foraging patterns. So we're in the middle of winter right now. What should I be drinking?
Well, Illawarra plums have just finished. We've got a load of that. So realising the best way to harvest them, to preserve them, and then to prepare them. So with Illawarra plums, because it's a totally different type of fruit, it's a swollen stem of a pine. So it's got a very sappy kind of, so the best way you find is to like blend it all up and then strain it and then take that juice, and been doing some great kombucha batches with that juice. What else? Lemon myrtles all year round.
The eucalypts are kind of an adventurous time to go around this time of year because you don't have as much fruit in winter. You got citrus, which is obviously the best part about winter because there's all the different citruses which are popping up all over the place. But yeah, no, it's learning more about the eucalypts is kind of an interesting path to go down. It's
What can you make out of eucalyptus?
We use it in a couple of our different flavours that we put out, like the leaves. You can make a tisane from the leaves and then mix that into your syrups, tinctures or cordials. Or smoking the booze or the cocktail, we use it in a smoking gun, the E-Gunny eucalypt, or any of them, and the flavour of the eucalypt smoke really picks up in the alcohol. You can do it that way. You can make mescaline from eucalypts, apparently, if you juice it down enough.
That's a different business venture.
3D drinks.
Thursday night, hang around.
Astro Botanicals.
You did say that it's really labour intensive running this business sustainably. I'm wondering how much of your time you actually spend in the garden getting these ingredients.
On the way here and on the way there, it's kind of like as you're going around, you'll notice that trees, you don't know streets by street names as much anymore. You know by that tree's down there, that Illawarra plum or that lily pool is going to be like right down there soon, and you go down and hit it up. So we're kind of tie that into our days, and we'll go around and get a big abundance of that. We've got a great connection to some local farmers as well down in the Southern Highlands area, and we'll go down there and pick fruit and kind of do
but then
that.
Then once you've got it, you've got to prep it, otherwise it's going to spoil in your fridge. So it was the first year of variety season. It was like, quick, we've got to get all these. We need all of these, and we got a load, and we were really successful. But then it's done. Then you've got to allocate that same amount of time as the picking to the sorting through it, taking off the stuff, washing it, cryovacking it, freezing it, you know, or prepping it there. So there's big time on that side of things as well. And then the next year, then we knew it was like, right, we're going to grab them. And then it's like, don't let any go bad. Yeah, they're my favourite ribaries. I love ribery season.
We're in a warehouse right now in the Inner West. Are you growing anything around here that you can use?
Out the front in the compost heap, there's some of the stuff sprouting from the seeds, like ribaries and Illawarra plums. They're both sprouting up. But then when they pop up, then we grab them, put them in a compost cup and go and chuck them out somewhere in the wild.
Give them to people to take with them when you're at an event. It's like, go plant this, gorilla plant. It's like, well, how big will it grow? It's like, as big as you, look after it, make it happy.
You don't have to put it in your garden.
Yeah,
that's the thing.
Put it in someone else's
or a good spot.
And people are keen. Like, we've got the opportunity to go out and speak.
And you get to talk to drunk people at parties when they're more susceptible to taking on information. I mean, like, when we've used insects as garnish before for margaritas, we did that for a while. So then, you know, it's like, come on, eat the cricket. And it's like, no, it's like, come on, we're all going to culturally evolve as a species together here with a bit of booze under a margarita. You know, it's like, where do we get our protein from? Let's think about this, you know.
People can live sustainably in this post-capitalist society, which we're kind of pushing
towards.
It's
all about the narrative, you know. We just take the narrative back.
Is it fair to say you're changing the narrative one sustainable cocktail at a time?
I like that. Yeah. Can we use that?
Trolley'd run a non-market socialist kombucha initiative at their warehouse on Saturdays. It's called Culture Clubbing. Check out 2ser.com for details.
What do you do when your job is taken by a robot? Where does all your e-waste go? How do you split your digital assets when you break up with your partner? This is Think Digital Futures. Each week, an exploration of the moral and mind-boggling questions that face us in the digital age. You can listen on your favourite podcast app. Just search for Think Digital Futures.
You're listening to Think Sustainability on 2SER. I'm Jake Malcolm. How many times have you reached the supermarket checkout and realised you forgot to bring your own bag, so you're forced to use plastic? Bringing a reusable bag is easy to forget, but one community group is trying to make you remember. And they're doing that by getting you to make the bag yourself. They're called Boomerang Bags, and they're a group of volunteers who get together and sew reusable shopping bags out of recycled materials, so you can refuse plastic bags at the checkout. Producer Liat Samoglu went to a local sewing bee at Reverse Garbage in Marrickville in Sydney's Inner West to find out more.
So Boomerang Bags is essentially just about providing a sustainable alternative to plastic bags. So communities get together to make the bags out of recycled materials, and then they're distributed in various different ways, whether that's at the supermarket so that when people have that I forgot my bag moment, there's something there available for them, or they sometimes are just simply handed out at local events or markets. Just as a tool to start a conversation and get people into the habit of using reusables.
This is Jordan DeBoer. She's the co-founder of Boomerang Bags, a collective that started in 2013 with the aim to reduce plastic bag use in her local community in Burleigh Heads. Jordan would get together with other members of her community and organise sewing bees, where they would cut, sew and screen print reusable bags made out of recycled material so that the community can use these bags up at the local shops instead of using plastic. Since then, Boomerang Bags has spread all around Australia and overseas to New Zealand, Canada and even Iceland, with more and more communities starting their own Boomerang Bag collectives. So how did Boomerang Bags begin, and how did it grow to become as widespread as it is? Jordan explains.
I was always, I guess, pretty passionate about environmentalism, and I was involved in a lot of cleanup and plastic reduction activities at the time. And then I was introduced to Tanya through a mutual friend because she was also, I guess, on a similar path and pretty passionate about solutions to plastic pollution. And we just kind of wanted to do a small project within our little community that would tackle plastic bags and I guess tackle it in a way that was reducing it at the source rather than cleanup efforts. We started by getting a few friends together and making bags, and then that extended into, you know, getting schools and other community members involved. And it went really well in our local community. And then after that, we got contacted by others around Australia, and I guess sort of realised that there was scope to scale it up and give other people the tools to be able to implement it locally.
Over to Sydney's inner west, and the Dulwich Hill Boomerang Bags community only just started a few months back when two locals, Rachel Dunlop and Natasha Doran, decided to do something to reduce plastic bag waste in the small inner city suburb of Dulwich Hill. Here's Natasha from that group.
I think the concept of Boomerang Bags started with the idea that it was to introduce the community, the broader community, to just being more aware of their use of plastic bags. And then that kind of went into, well, we can make our own bags from fabric that's been donated or just offcuts or pillowcases, you know, reusing fabric that's already out there to make the new bags as well. So, just making people think about the use of plastic, that was the main driver, especially not just for the Boomerang Bags community as a whole, but also here in Dulwich Hill, that was our big driver as well.
Co-founder Rachel Dunlop explains why they chose the Dulwich Hill community.
So the idea is you have hubs, and we've chosen Dulwich Hill because it's kind of quite a small villagey feel. So not many of us live in Dulwich Hill. We're all kind of inner Westies. In fact, we had some people last time from the eastern suburbs come over. But we just thought Dulwich Hill's a nice kind of environment, and people walk a lot to the shops because the idea is you take the bag away and then you bring it back again, and we don't want all the bags just to disappear.
One of the most important aspects of Boomerang Bags is the community involvement, Rachel explains.
We've got some elderly people, some retired people. We've got families coming along. We've got lots of children. The children are particularly interested in the screen printing because our screen printer's a retired teacher, so she's great. So, yeah, no, all sorts of people.
Original Boomerang Bags founder Jordan agrees.
But I think that the biggest impact really comes from getting the community together to make the bags, and that's what we found as soon as we started. But there was actually so many conversations that were started between, you know, all demographics of the community that were getting together at these sewing bees, you know, everyone from 11 years old through to 85 years old, talking about plastic and talking about, you know, where they're finding their plastic-free groceries and the local markets and all sorts of other issues that weren't just limited to plastic bags, but it extended into all sorts of sustainability issues.
And sustainability is a big issue among these communities. I spoke to a group of young girls who are helping out at the Dulwich Hill Boomerang Bag Sewing Bee and asked them why reducing plastic bag use was really important to them.
Well, I think that plastic bags, obviously, once they are used, they are usually dropped everywhere and you won't be able to recycle them. They break and they fall into gutters and they go down into oceans and they can kill
it's better to have like these sort of bags because they're more sustainable, they're more like, and you can like wash them again, and it's like, it's more like pleasant to sort of use them again as well.
And like it takes ages for plastic bags to break down.
Rachel Dunlop says she hopes the group can launch Boomerang Bags Dulwich Hill by the end of the year.
I think it's September when we have the Dulwich Hill Fair. So we've got a stall at the Dulwich Hill Fair and we're going to sell some bags there as well, some different kind of bags, you know, bags made out of old jeans and things like that. That's to raise money for the project. But we're hoping that as soon as that's happened, and as soon as we've got 1,000 bags, then we'll launch it. I've already got businesses who are interested up there to get involved, but we don't want to start and run out of bags, because I don't think, from what I read, like the boomerang concept doesn't necessarily work. So the bags might go, they might not come back, but that's all good as long as those people are reusing the bags and taking them when they go shopping and not picking up plastic bags.
The Dulwich Hill Boomerang Bag Collective meet up at Reverse Garbage on the first Saturday of the month for their sewing bee. They have a Facebook page set up if you'd like to get involved. Also, if you wanted to start your own boomerang bag group, you can head to boomerangbags.org to find out more info.
Liat Samoglu with that story. More and more houses around Sydney are installing solar panels onto their rooftops. But what about apartment dwellers? Strata laws and less owner-occupied apartments are some of the reasons why the solar boom hasn't taken off with apartments. But Bjorn Stormberg from the University of Technology Sydney has some ideas as to how that could change. Bjorn spoke with Liat Samoglu.
Why has it been particularly hard for apartments to install solar power over houses?
So there are two aspects to that. One is that apartments tend to have a lot of renters in them, and that brings into play the split incentive problem where the owner of the property doesn't want to pay for the investment in solar panels when all of the solar electricity is then going to flow just to the tenant. And then the very specific thing about apartments is that even if all the owners wanted to get solar, there's still complications around who owns the roof and how you go about installing solar on what is in almost all cases a shared roof. So the roof is the property, is part of the common area of the apartment, so it needs to go through the body corporate or the strata committee.
How can people, though, that live in apartments install solar power? Is it possible?
Yeah, it's absolutely possible. So there are kind of three options. One, which is what we did at Stucco Cooperative over in Newtown, is to convert the whole building into an embedded network where the whole building is pooled into one shared energy customer from the grid, and then you can install solar and share solar kind of behind the whole building's meter. So often you hear solar being referred to as being behind the meter, rooftop solar at least being behind the meter.
What does that mean?
So that means that you are supplying yourself behind the meter. So you are replacing or displacing some of your local energy demand within your building with the solar that you produce locally. And then in contrast to that, things that are in front of the meter is, say, a solar farm, something that is on the grid side of the electricity network rather than being on the local homes kind of demand side. And so that's one way of doing it. That's not what I would advise most people to do. There are two much more simple and straightforward ways of installing solar in an apartment building. One is that you just install solar on the roof, somewhere on the common property, which is the roof, and then use that solar system to supply the common area's load. Mm-hmm. So in an apartment building, that's typically like the lifts, communal lighting, you might have a pool, those sorts of things that are the shared amenities of the building. And in that way, the kind of the sinking fund or the pot of money that belongs to the body corporate gets used to invest in the solar system, and the returns of the solar electricity that's being produced directly flows to the body corporate as well.
How many solar panels would you need to be installed just to power, say, the common lighting in an apartment block of, I don't know, say 12?
Probably not very much.
Yeah.
So it really comes down to the specifics of each building. So that there, the advice is that it really is worth getting at least three solar companies to give quotes or engaging a consulting company to do an assessment on that. Because it really does come down to what, like, how many lights, when are they on, what type of lights, all these sorts of things. And lighting is generally a relatively poor match for solar because it's used more in the evening times than in the daytimes. But if you have things that are running all the time, so another example is bigger apartment buildings that have car parks often have fans that ventilate the car parks to get the carbon monoxide and other gases out of there. And they'll generally run 24/7, although it's another good, that kind of reminds me that to say that it's always worth doing energy efficiency upgrades before putting in solar. So in that example, it's worth getting fans that only operate when they sense that the carbon monoxide levels rise above a certain threshold. That can already reduce your electricity usage quite a bit. But there's also a third way in which apartments can get solar, which is that they can install lots of small solar systems. So say your example of 12, let's take your example of the apartment with 12 units. So they probably don't have that much demand in the common area. Let's assume they don't have lifts and whatnot. And then it's probably better to use the roof space that's available, installs 12 individual solar systems and wire each one of those into each of the individual people's units. That way they can then use that power during the day to power their fridge, their kettles, their laptops, their computers, all the things that they're using domestically can then be covered by their personal solar system.
So you
happens to just be on the shared roof. So for something
like a two-bedroom apartment, you could essentially use just one solar unit. What percentage of a household could that power?
It sorry for being so flighty on this. It really depends.
Yeah, of course.
On your usage pattern. So there's two, and yeah, when I say a solar system, I mean like a solar, not as one module. I mean probably like four modules, four panels. With that, I mean something on that order, like 1 kilowatt to 2-3 kilowatts, something like that. What I will say is that I think the average size of solar installs in New South Wales or Australia is sitting at around 4 to 5 kilowatts these days, and there's a lot of incentives to kind of maximize the amount of solar you can get on your roof. With the way electricity prices are skyrocketing, and now, to be fair, also in the way in which the feed-in tariffs, which is the amount of money you get for any excess solar that you supply and sell back to the grid, that's also increased, almost doubling from in New South Wales around 6 cents to now around 12 cents per kilowatt hour. And the fact that we still have government rebates in the form of the small scale technology certificates, STCs, and the fact that a lot of the cost of installing a solar system is just getting the installer out there, getting the electrician to wire it all up, that while you're doing this, it really is worth going all out and getting solar to cover as much of your sunny roof as possible.
Bjorn Stormberg, visiting fellow from the University of Technology Sydney, speaking to Think Sustainability's Leah Tsamaglou. Thanks for listening to the show. If you like what you heard today, make sure to subscribe to Think Sustainability on your favourite podcast app. Just search for Think Sustainability. And while you're there, leave us a review. It helps us get discovered. You can also go to our website, 2ser.com, to find out more about the show. This show is a collaboration between the University of Technology Sydney and 2SER Radio. I'm Jake Morecambe. I'll see you next week.